Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture is titled The Missing Vessels of the Temple and is dedicated to the memory and the Ilui Nishmos Daniel Ben Zelig, Mr. Daniel Ray, Yisrael Avram Ben Eliyahu, Mr. Abe Letman, and Yisrael Ben Yitzchok Yehuda, Mr. Isidore Chesla, Aleihem Hasholom of Blessed Memory.
The Talmud describes the city of Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, as the most beautiful city in the world. According to the Gemara in Kedushin, Mem Tes Amud Beis in 49b, 10 measures of beauty came down to the world. 9 were taken by Yerushalayim. Describing the temple that was destroyed by the Romans, there's a passage from the Talmud in Sukkah, Nun Aleph Amud Beis in 51b, that it was the most beautiful building in the world. Unfortunately, both Yerushalayim and the Beis HaMikdash and the Temple are no longer here. The Talmud Yerushalmi describes that destruction that in a sense that since the Jews had reached a level that they were condemned to be punished, the punishment was taken less on the body of Jewry and more on the wood and the stones of the temple. In other words, physical objects were destroyed. To a great degree, many of the people were saved. The major thrust of the destruction was in that beautiful city and that beautiful temple. We know about the destruction of wood and stone. What about all the treasures that were in the temple? What are all the vessels in the temple? Where are they today? Really, the subject of tonight's lecture is I would like to acquaint you using the original sources, as we're going to go through the sources, that afterwards, hopefully, you'll know as much as I do about the subject. The first area that I would like to discuss is the Mishkan, the tabernacle. You're all familiar with in the first year of the Exodus, they started building the tabernacle. They left Passover time in the spring. Already by the fall, they started putting together the tabernacle, the Mishkan. According to Midrashic sources, it was finished, in other words, at least the basic building blocks, were finished Hanukkah time. Already in the beginning of the winter. But it was delayed, and the dedication was in the beginning of the spring of the next year, the first day of the Hebrew month of Nisan. And from that time on, it was in continual use for some 480 years. And I'd like, and this is on the first page here on the handouts, here on section 1, paragraph A, the Rambam traces the history of that Mishkan, of the tabernacle. As soon as they entered the land, they erected the Mishkan, the tabernacle, in Gilgal. It was there with them some 39 years in the desert. All told, they're 40 years in the desert. But it was erected in the beginning of the second year. So all told, it was there 39 years in the desert. Once they crossed the wilderness, they came into Israel, they placed this tabernacle in the area called Gilgal. And there it was for a period of 14 years. While they were busy conquering the land, which was the first 7 years, and dividing the land, at least the major divisions of the land, which took the next 7 years. At the end of some 14 years, they moved the tabernacle, which was in Gilgal, this area called Gilgal, and they moved it to Shiloh. And it was in Shiloh that it took a more permanent stance. In that, as you're familiar, the Mishkan, the tabernacle, the walls were made of acacia wood, atzei shittim, which was gilded. In Shiloh, instead of this acacia wood, the walls were made of stone. But they were much the same dimensions of the original. And as we call from the Rambam, from there they came to Shiloh, and they built there a house of stone, and spread the curtains of the Mishkan over it. But the curtains, in other words, the Mishkan, the tabernacle consisted of these gilded wooden boards, which were the walls, covered by these curtains. Those curtains were still there in Shiloh.
You're saying they got rid of the wood?
Or no, it was just temporarily put away, that's all. And there was no roof there, in other words, a permanent wooden roof, it was those curtains, just it was as it was in the tabernacle. For a period of 369 years, the Mishkan, the tabernacle, stood at Shiloh. When Eli, who was the, at the end of those 369 years, Eli was the high priest there. When he died, and actually there was a whole incident described in the first book of Samuel, Shmuel, that the Ark, the Oron HaKodesh, is the holy ark, which contained the tablets, the Ten Commandments, the Luchos HaBris. They were taken out to war. They were captured by the Philistines. They were held in Philistine territory for some 6 months. They returned back to the Jews, but they never, during that time, they didn't go back to their normative place, which was in the Holy of Holies of the tabernacle, but it was put into a separate area. And the, what we call now this Mishkan, in other words, this tabernacle minus the ark, was first put into a place called Nov, and then it was put into a place called Givon. All told, the time that the tabernacle, again, without the ark and the tablets, because they were in a separate area, in the period of Nov, and the period of Givon was 57 years. After this 57-year period, the temple was dedicated. The temple was built. So here we've traced, again, in paragraph A, we've traced the history of the Mishkan up until the building of the temple in Yerushalayim. Let me just summarize what we know from the history again. They built it, in other words, it was dedicated at the beginning of the second year in their sojourn in the desert. They were in the desert after that for some 39 years. After that, they moved and put it into a place called Gilgal for 14 years. They moved it from Gilgal to Shiloh, and in Shiloh it took a semi-permanent thing because it had walls of stones, but besides it was much the same. And the temporary wood, acacia wood, was put in storage during that period of time. From then, it was moved to Nov, and then to Givon. Altogether, Nov and Givon was 57 years, and then the temple was built. The period from the Exodus and from the beginning of the Exodus to the dedication of the temple was 480 years. The building of the temple is 480 years. So here we have around that, when the Mishkan was in some form, it was being utilized. Now we go on to paragraph B. We found the transformation. Now we're dedicating the temple. Here I quote, you can just look at it yourself. This is from Melachim Aleph, the first book of Kings, in chapter 8, where it's described they remove the tabernacle from the city of Givon. They took the ark, which at that time was in Yerushalayim. They took the ark and put it into the Holy of Holies, the Kodesh HaKadoshim, in the temple. But there's no mention in this scripture what they did with the tabernacle. All they said is just simply, they removed the tabernacle, brought it up. They said, they took the ark, put it into the Holy of Holies. But what they did with that Mishkan is not mentioned. And really, that what happened with the Mishkan is part of the oral tradition. And if you turn now to page 2, just when the Beis HaMikdash, when the Holy Temple was built, this is taken from the Tosefta. The Tosefta are brisos. They are, this is literature which was composed parallel to the Mishnah, the same time of the Mishnah. It fills in many of the details of the Mishnah. And this is the Tosefta from the 13th chapter from the Tractate Sota. It says, when the Beis HaMikdash, when the Holy Temple was built, the Mishkan, the tabernacle, was hidden together with all its parts. It had hooks, boards, bars, columns, sockets, everything, the whole thing was hidden. However, according to this Tosefta, there were at least two vessels mentioned here, as if you read it, that were not hidden, but were actually in use in the temple. And that was the table and the menorah, the candelabra. They were both in use. In other words, so they were taken out of the tabernacle and put into the new temple. But the Mishkan as a whole, the tabernacle as a whole, was hidden. This Tosefta does not mention where it was hidden. It just makes us think it was hidden. There is a passage from the Talmud, from the Gemara in Sota, in Tesamad Aleph, in 9a, that asks the question, where was it hidden? And it brings a tradition, Rav Chisda said, name of Avimi, it is under the catacombs of the sanctuary. In other words, where the temple was built, the mountain was not a solid bedrock, but actually is full of caverns. And it was placed in one of the caverns, which is under the area of where the sanctuary was built. I mean, even to this day, archaeologists have discovered caverns there. In other words, these vaults, these catacombs underneath this. It is in one of those catacombs. It was probably sealed in a way that it was probably inaccessible. I mean, but it is really underneath. It is in that area. Now, one could ask the question, there is a difference between burying something and hiding something. If you bury it, it means permanently that's where it's going to be. If you hide it, that means you're eventually going to go and take it out. What is the fate of the Mishkan? In other words, is it this tabernacle? Is it hidden or is it buried? And for that, we're going to the next citation, E. It says, Atzei Shitim Omdim. In other words, the acacia wood standing up. The Talmud derives from this verse something which affects us in daily practice, in yearly practice, so to speak. One explanation is it was standing, and it was standing up straight. And there's the way it stands. And there's the bottom on the bottom, as the wood grows, and the top on the top. And it learns from this a principle in Jewish halacha, that when you're taking something, you have to hold it in the way that it's grown. Therefore, when you take your esrog on Sukkos, you have to hold it. In other words, that the stem is on the bottom and the pitum, the top, is on top, because that's how it grows on the tree. And if you hold it opposite, you can't fulfill the mitzvah. And that's why when we make a bracha on the lulav, we hold it reverse, and then after we make that bracha, we turn it over and to take the lulav. It's based on at least a principle which is derived from this verse. However, there's another principle that's derived from this verse, and that's what touches the subject here. It continues, maybe Shema Tov, maybe you say, in other words, that the end, I'd say that the tabernacle, all hope is lost. In other words, there's no hope, there's no expectation. These were eventually buried, they will disappear, they will disintegrate, with time. And here it says, Scripture says, Their omdim, they stand for all time. And Rashi explains they will eventually be taken out of its hiding place. And eventually will be, you know, the collective property of the Jewish people. So from this Rashi, we see the fate of this Mishkan is now it is hidden. It is hidden in a catacomb under where the sanctuary was. Eventually will be taken out and will be open for full viewing. That's where the Mishkan is. Yes?
Well, this is talking about the acacia wood, and that's the part that was covered with gold?
Right.
And that's the part that had been from before but not after? What happened to the part with the stone?
Yeah.
Is that something...
Oh, wait, maybe we'll just... That acacia wood was originally, that was the Mishkan. That was the tabernacle, right? That was the walls of the tabernacle. When they came to Shiloh, they temporarily put it, you know, away, used the stone walls. Right? Afterwards, again, they weren't using those stone walls anymore. Then it became temporary. It was moved to Nov, it was moved to Givon. And this temporary thing, it was hidden. It's understood, well, if that's hidden, then the whole kit and caboodle is hidden. Everything is hidden. And it will eventually come out and become part of the national Jewish treasury, so to speak. And so it's not buried, but it's hidden. What is the fate of the Ark? Those who've seen the movie know. Yeah. But as we're going to see, the Talmud takes a different tack. There are actually, as we're going to see, several various traditions, opinions, as to where that Oren, where the Ark of the Ten Commandments is today. And if you'll follow me, it says on page 2, and really we're quoting now another Tosefta, as we quoted the Tosefta in the 13th chapter of Sota, number the first halacha, now we're going to quote the second. When the Ark was hidden, there was hidden with it, it was in section 2, paragraph A, the bottle containing the manna, because that was put together with it. That contained it's a mistake, it's sprinkling, it's a sprinkling oil. It was the oil that was used to anoint, it was a mistake. So it was to anoint the Kohanim, the high priest. It never got lessened, right? That never got lessened. That was hidden. The staff of Aaron, that miraculous thing, that was the wooden piece. There was a piece of wood that started sprouting almonds and flowers. This was in Parshas Korach to prove the special quality of Aaron was almonds and blossoms. That was for all time. The chest, we mentioned the Philistines had taken the ark. It was there for 6 months. It was returned to the Jews. They returned it back with a gift of this golden box. And that golden box, again, was also a testimony to the miracle of the return. That was hidden. Who hid it? It says Yoshua hid it. Yoshua was from the last of the kings of Judea. I believe it was in the 18th year of his reign he hid it. He reigned for 31 years. So 13 years before the end of his reign, he hid the Oren. After him, he had three sons and a grandson that reigned after him for some 22 years. So you have 13 years. In 22 years, some 35 years before the destruction of the temple, the ark was hidden, at least according to this tradition. So again, we have that we know in the second temple, the ark was not there. There's a Mishnah in Yoma. This is the Kohen Gadol really just, he went to the place where the stone, where it used to stand on that stone. It's called Evan Shasiya, the stone where the ark normally stood. But it wasn't there. According to this, it wasn't there some 35 years before the destruction of the first temple. But that's one tradition. We're going to quote now another tradition. If you just on the third or fourth line here on page 3. Rabbi Eliezer said the ark went into exile to Babylonia. According to him, it was not hidden, it was taken into exile. Rabbi Shimon adds to this that he identifies when it was taken into exile. According to Rabbi Shimon, it was taken to exile some 11 years before the destruction of the temple. And he quotes a verse, if you see in your notes, he quotes a verse that the precious vessels of the house of the Lord were taken into exile. The precious vessels of the house of the Lord refers to the ark, to the Oren. So according to this, it wasn't 35 years before, it was 11 years, and it was not hidden, but it was taken by force by the Babylonians. According to this tradition, we have no information of what happened to it afterwards. It just doesn't say. We can only conjecture. But there's no real information. Rabbi Yehuda ben Lachish said, the ark, now we have a different tradition, was hidden in its place. In other words, as if there would be some catacomb directly below that area, you know, like 200 feet below something. Directly below that area, there was some hidden cave, and that's where it is today, according to Yehuda ben Lachish. And he brings a verse to support this. So just, again, let's summarize what we have so far here. We have the opinion that it was hidden 35 years before the destruction of the temple by the king Yosha. And if you notice the notes, said the reason he hid it was that he felt that it was going to be, they were going to be taken into exile, it should not go with the same fate of the rest of the temple, and therefore it should be afforded special treatment, it should be hidden. It was Yoshio's decision. It doesn't seem that it was a directive from a prophet. It seems to have been a decision based on logic. At least that's how it seems to be presented to us. Where it was hidden according to that opinion, we don't have an inkling yet. We have a second tradition that says it was taken by the Babylonians. What happened afterwards? Question mark. We don't know. The third opinion is that it was hidden in a specific place underneath the place of where the, you know, where it stood. You know, so directly below someplace, there's some hidden vault that holds it now. However, as we're going to see on page 3 in paragraph B, we have a tradition here as to exactly, according at least to the first opinion, that doesn't identify a place. Says there's a tradition where that place is. Rav Nachman says it was taught that the ark was hidden away in the chamber of the woodshed. If you're familiar, the Temple Mount was a platform that was 500 cubits by 500 cubits. Within the Temple Mount area, there were two courtyards. If you were going from the east to west, the first courtyard that you entered was the courtyard of Ezras Noshim, the courtyard of the women. It was 135 cubits by 135 cubits. From there, you entered the courtyard of the Azura of the temple courtyard, was 135 cubits wide, 187 cubits long, deep. In the courtyard of the women, the Ezras Noshim, they were actually connected to four rooms. And those rooms didn't have a roof on them, they were like, again, mini courtyards on the four corners of them. One of those mini courtyards is called Lishchas Dir Ho'etzim. This is the room, this is a woodshed. This is where wood was stored to be used in the temple. That's where, before it was taken out, it was inspected that it shouldn't rot, it shouldn't become wormy. So this is where wood was held and processed. He says, underneath that woodshed is where the ark is today, according to this Gemara, in this tradition. Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchok supports this with a Mishnah in Shkolim. And we're taught it happened, we'll read this here on page 3, paragraph B, it happened to a certain priest who was whiling away his time, they saw a block of pavement that was different from the others. Notice he's working in this woodshed area, and he sees one of the stones a little different than the others. He came and informed his fellow, but before he could complete his account, his soul departed. He died in the middle. They knew definitely that the ark was hidden there. What had he been doing? Chelvo says he was, according to this, he was playing with his axe. In other words, it would seem, according to this, that he died because the axe fell. In other words, and he died of his wounds. However, the school of Rabbi Yishmael had a different tradition, and it says in great detail. In other words, normally priests that had some sort of a physical blemish did not serve in the temple. But they had other functions. And they were used, amongst their functions, they were used in terms of supplying the processing of this wood. So two priests afflicted with a blemish, their bali mumen, were sorting the woods when the axe of one of them slipped from his hand and fell on that place, whereupon a flame burst forth and consumed him. So according to this tradition, again, it's in that place. So again, let's just summarize. According to one we have, it's underneath the woodshed. That woodshed area, not a shed in that sense. It's really it's an open courtyard, but that's where wood was stored. It was in the woodshed. Before, it was really underneath the place, underneath the place where the Urim was originally placed. It was in the Holy of Holies. And we have this other opinion that it was taken to Babel, to Babylonia, and we don't know where it is now. Not that it isn't in a specific place, we just don't have any information about it. All the traditions we've studied till now are Talmudic traditions. In other words, these were the ones that were preserved by the sages of the Talmud. There is another source of tradition outside of mainstream tradition. In other words, when we speak about Talmudic tradition, we mean about traditions that were maintained in the yeshivas. It was by the sages. But there are traditions which are part of folklore. They're not part of, these aren't taught in the yeshivas. This is just part of the traditions of the people as a whole. And one of the works which is outside the pale of Jewish literature, of the Talmudic literature, was called the Svarim Chitzonim, the outer works, or as we know, it's called the Apocrypha. There's a whole literature that starts where the Hebrew Bible ends. The Hebrew Bible ends with the book of Nehemiah, and this is the chronology, the end of the Persian Empire. There is, and any book written after that has no innate sanctity. It's not Kisvei HaKodesh. However, there's a whole literature that exists that was written after that time. There's the book of Ben Sira, the wisdom of Ben Sira, which is often quoted in the Talmud. There are the historical books of the Maccabees. There's Maccabees 1, written by one author, and Maccabees 2, another totally different book, written by another author. The Catholics have included them in their Bible, because it's a link between the period of the so-called Old Testament, in other words, the Hebrew Bible, and their so-called New Testament, as the Christian Bible. There's a big gap, from the end of the Persian era, which is the Hebrew Bible, to the life of the founder of Christianity. It's that gap is filled with this literature. So at least according to the Catholics, it really has sanctity. The Protestants, it doesn't, and of course the Jews, it certainly doesn't. This following quote is taken from the second book of Maccabees. So it's really, again, it's outside Talmudic tradition, but I just wanted to give you as much information as I have about the subject. Here it says, as you can look, inside in the thing. It was also in the writing that the prophet, in obedience, we'll see who that prophet was, in obedience to a revelation, gave orders that the tent, referring to the tabernacle, and the ark should accompany him, and he went away to the mountain where Moses went up and beheld God's inheritance. As he went to Har Nevo, the mountain of Nevo, where Moses went up and died. And that's where it was hidden. And Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah, was the one who hid it. And he found a cave, and he blocked up the door, and that's where it is to this day. And when Mashiach comes, according to this tradition, it will be opened up. So according to this tradition, it is not on the Temple Mount somewhere, but really it is on the, in Transjordan. And according to this, which is different than what we had before, that the tent and the ark are hidden together. According to Talmudic tradition, separate hiding, right? The tent is hidden in one of the vaults under the sanctuary. And that was hidden, it was hidden, and it's gone, it wasn't moved. There's no mention of it being ever moved afterwards. I mean, the whole idea of hidden means it was put in a place that's inaccessible. Right. And here we find the tabernacle and the ark hidden together. This is a non-Talmudic tradition. I just want, again, in fairness, and the reason is because modern scholars bring this following text on page 4, to give you an inkling, again, this is not a Talmudic tradition, but just to give you an inkling of a midrashic source, which seems to run counter to some of the things we have studied and will study right now. There are two types, just in case you'll ever find it, there are two types of midrashim. There are two types of thing which we call medrash. One is the medrash that's in the Talmud, or which it runs parallel to the Talmud. You know, there's midrashic source, they got it in the Talmud, in the Babylonian Talmud, the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Palestinian Talmud. There's the Medrash Rabbah, which is widely, which Rashi quotes in his commentary. The Medrash Tanchuma, Tana Deve Eliyahu, Pirkei D'Rav Eliezer. These are all part of any yeshiva library. In other words, these are texts which are used and expounded upon. There are other Midrashim, they call the same Medrash, which do not have that same sense of validity. They are in rare collections of collected Midrashim. The following medrash is of that nature. The first recorded printing of this medrash is in a Kabbalistic sefer, a Kabbalistic work called Emek HaMelech, which quotes this whole medrash. As you'll see, it's a fascinating medrash. But it's the first one who quotes this. In 1952, two large marble tablets were found in Beirut. And inscribed on those tablets was this medrash. So, the medrash is composed, it's called Medrash Meseches Kelim, the medrash of the tractate of vessels. Not to be confused with the Mishnah, which is Meseches Kelim, you know, which is part of the Mishnayos, which is it has the laws of the composition of various vessels and their status of you know ritual purity of Tumah and Taira. This is just a special medrash called Meseches Kelim. And if we can just briefly go over some of this, just to give you a sense of, it doesn't seem totally to jive with the other material. The first paragraph here is on page 4 in English. These are the holy vessels that were hidden when the temple was destroyed. The tabernacle, the veil, again, this is all part of the holy menorah. Do you notice the menorah being hidden? We had no recollection of the menorah being hidden before. Remember, we had the tabernacle hidden, the menorah went and being used in the temple. Right? We didn't have anything of a menorah being hidden. Right? This is different. This runs counter to, you know, the Talmudic tradition. Generally, the traditional attitude to all these things is that the Talmudic tradition is the most reliable because it was maintained within the yeshivas and it was the most reliable. But scholars are aware of this, and the secular aware of this matter, especially after it was discovered in Beirut. And I'd just like to show it to you, just to give you an inkling of the totality of the information that's available. The Ark of the Testimony, came the Luchos. the forehead plate of gold. This is the tzitz. In other words, this is the golden plate that was on the forehead of the high priest, was hidden. It would seem to the idea of the fact that it was hidden would be indicative, perhaps, as referring to the original one that Aaron wore. In other words, again, when the Mishkan was hidden, all the paraphernalia of the Mishkan, all the begodim, everything was hidden. So when Shlomo made his new temple, everything was new. But into that, the holy crown of Aaron the priest, because it mentions Aaron here, so in the sense that this is a historical artifact. The breastplate of justice and the trumpets of silver. And just as a note about the breastplate of justice, the Chosha Mishpah, that's part of the clothing of the high priest. However, the trumpets of silver, there really is a very interesting medrash regarding this. And that medrash actually does fit in with this. There's a Gemara in Yoma, in 7 in Dafayin Beis, that says that the chatzotros, the trumpets that Moshe used, in the desert, after his death, they were hidden. They were not to be used again. And there's a medrash that says, when will these trumpets be used? They will be used at the time of the war of Gog and Magog. In other words, this final messianic war. One of the great scholars in the early 20th century, Meir Simcha of Dvinsk, who wrote the work Meshech Chochma, explained that these trumpets were trumpets, one of the functions was for war. The war that Moshe used this for was the war of Sihon and Og. This was a miraculous war, so to speak. The war that will be fought with Gog and Magog is also a miraculous war. In other words, it has a special function, and it was hidden. So it would follow, perhaps this is Moses. Then it goes the Chruvim, the altar, the burnt offering, the veil of the tent of appointment, the forks, bowls, the table. You notice the table here. That does not go with what we've learned before. The partition of the entrance, the copper altar, the holy raiments of the high priest we wear on Yom Kippur, which also falls within tradition in that there's the opinion, which is the majority opinion, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, had special clothing on Yom Kippur. After Yom Kippur, there were linen clothing. After Yom Kippur, they were put away permanently. So perhaps this was hidden together with that. The bells of pomegranates were on the hem of the robe. Again, this goes into the clothing of the high priest. The holy vessels that Moshe made at Mount Sinai, the commandment of Hashem, and the staff and jug of manna. According to this, you get the impression that everything that was used by Moshe was hidden. Menorah, shulchan, vessels. We don't have that sense before, and we're going to see something that runs counter afterwards. What's very interesting in the next two paragraphs was, okay, that was hidden. That could be that was hidden at the beginning of the time of Solomon. There's a new hiding. The Babylonians are coming. The temple is about to be destroyed. To protect the treasures of the temple, according to this tradition, there was a special hiding. And the person who hid this was Shimur the Levite, Shimur HaLevi, together with his colleagues, were named Chizkiah, Tzidkiah, Chagai the prophet. This is from the last prophets. And Zechariah ben Berechiah ben Ido, the prophet, again from the last prophet. So according to this, the very holy and scholarly people that were involved in hiding the treasures of the first temple. What were these treasures? You have a sense, and again, these are the vessels that were swallowed up by the ground. In other words, this seems to be from the tabernacle, bars, stakes, boards, rings, pillars of the courtyard. But the following are vessels from Solomon's temple. And again, the numbers are, as we're going to compare them afterwards, are astounding. 1,200,000 silver bowls, 50,000 gold bowls. Of the good gold, they have a different type of gold, 600,000. Of good silver, 1,200,000. I mean, the amounts are staggering. And these five wrote the Mishnahs in Babylon. In other words, the five before, says Shimur, Chizkiah, Tzidkiah, Haggai, and Zechariah, with the other prophets are with them, and Ezra the priest and scribe. And they all made, and this is the last paragraph, is taken from the 12th Mishnah, the last Mishnah of this Maseches Kehillim, in between the third, the way we just quoted, are as an enormous amount of jewels. I mean, it's just, again, it seems very legendary, and this, again, this is not part of Talmudic tradition. But they all swore never to reveal the whereabouts of these vessels until Mashiach comes. And according to this tradition, there's an enormous wealth that's there when Mashiach comes. However, if you look at Scripture, there's no hint of any hiding in Scripture of these vessels. We brought this tradition here, but Scripture on page 5, we seem to get a different view. There, if you just look over here on page 5, in paragraph A, B, and C, it describes the details of what happened. First, it went in details. First, Nebuchadnezzar made three attacks on the Jews, and little by little he took some of the treasures, a little more of the treasures. And finally, he took all the vessels of the house of Hashem, this is the last thing, great and small, and the treasures of his king and the princes, all this he took to Babylon. You get the sense he took everything. You don't get the sense that, you know, it was like this, you know, like this medrash. We know that they had them in Babylon. That's the story of Belshazzar. He was the last Babylonian king that took the vessels of the temple and drank from them and used them. And it's on this banquet that he had. When he used them, they saw their handwriting on the wall. And this was the end of the Babylonian. That night, the Persians came and destroyed his empire. If you look now on page 6 in paragraph E, where they describe after a year later, Cyrus became the king, started to return everything back. Now there's a list of all the vessels, it's underlined, of gold and silver were 5,400. Far cry from that 1,200,000. And you get the sense, well, they took a lot back, you know. You get just one added note to this, the fact is they brought it back. We have, the Talmud records that there were vessels that were in use in Moses' time that were used in the Second Temple. These weren't hidden. They were taken, and they were taken back, and they were used. One is a flute. Here's on paragraph F. It's a smooth, thin reed flute that dated from the time of Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu. And there was a copper mortar that was used to pound the spices used in the incense, the ketores, would date back from the time of Moses. They weren't hidden. Evidently, they were taken to Babylon, they were brought back, and they're still in use. You get the sense that there was no special hiding, despite the fact of this existence of this other tradition. What happened with the vessels of the Second Temple? Now, there's the First Temple. We describe this midrash, you know, that has this phenomenal things were hidden, and we don't find any supporting evidence to this either in Scripture or in Chazal and Talmudic literature. What happened with the second ones? So, if you notice, this is taken from Ovos de Rabbi Nosson. You're familiar with Pirkei Ovos. Ovos de Rabbi Nosson is an expanded version of Ovos. It's in the 41st chapter. It begins first describing, which we've studied before, all that were hidden with the tabernacle. But it goes on to what do the Romans take? The mortar of the house of Aftinus, those were the ones who prepared the incense, which it seems to be that was the mortar that was used in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. The table, the menorah, the curtain, and the forehead plate are still laying in Rome. The Romans took them, and this was written some 100 years afterwards. And these words were written, and they are still in Rome. Where they are today, we will talk about in a few minutes. Rabbi Lazar, Rabbi Yossi, this is approximately the year 180 or so, said, I was in Rome. There's a whole incident which was recorded in the tractate Me'ilah, 17b, where Rabbi Yossi had access to the royal treasure house of Caesar. He went in and he saw the tzitz, he saw the golden forehead plate, and he saw the proichas, he saw the curtain. As he was an eyewitness, he saw them, and he describes them. The last three quotes I have on page 7 are taken from a different source. They are taken from Josephus. Josephus was the Jewish historian of the period. During the time he went over to the Roman side, he was with the Roman army at the end of the siege of Jerusalem. In fact, he kept on making speeches to the populace, trying to convince them to sue for peace and to, you know, to give up. Seems he was there at the very end. And he describes, and we have three different incidents which touch upon, we're going to, what became of the treasures of the Second Temple. The first one is a quote from the speech that Titus made when he conquered the temple. And he says, you Jews, he says, you're ungrateful. How could you do this? And he says, and we'll read this. This is on page 7, paragraph C. What is our chief favor of all? We have given you leave to gather up that tribute which is paid to God. Every Jew across the world gave a half of shekel. Half a shekel of silver. They gave it to the temple with such other gifts that are dedicated to him. It was an enormous wealth that we allowed you to collect. Nor have we called those that carried those donations to account. Like, what are they doing? You know, nor prohibited them till at length you became richer than we ourselves, even since when you were our enemies. Titus claimed that there was more wealth in that temple than there was in all of Rome. What happened to it? We're going to speak about it in a second. The second citation is a first-hand account of what occurred when it was taken. Now we'll read this together. This is on page 7 and paragraph D. But now at this time, it was one of the priests, the son of Thebethus, whose name was Jesus. The Greek form of Yoshua, of Joshua, was Jesus. Upon his having security given him by the oath of Caesar, because Titus said before he went and conquered Jerusalem, says, anyone who defects now and deserts will live. Anyone who stays and fights will be killed. So he came in, and by rights, I mean, he would have killed everyone. However, he made a special oath to preserve him. Delivered to him certain of the precious things reposited in the temple, came out of it. And so he went into the temple. He came out from the wall of the holy house, two candlesticks, like those that lay in the holy house. In other words, these were replicas, in other words, replacements of the menorah. With tables, cisterns, vials, all made of solid gold and very heavy. Also delivered to him the veils and the garments with the precious stones and a great number of other precious vessels that belonged to their sacred worship. The treasure of the temple also, whose name was Pinchas, was seized upon and showed Titus the coats, the girdles of the priests with a great quantity of purple and scarlet, which were then reposited for uses of the veil. In other words, this is the raw material that was used to make the proichas, the veil. This was scarce. There was dyed, you know, with very scarce material. Also, a great deal of cinnamon and cassia, with a large quantity of other sweet spices, which used to be mixed together and offered as incense to God every day. In other words, he brought out the ketores, the incense. A great many other treasure also delivered to him with sacred ornaments of the temple, not a few, which things thus delivered to Titus obtained of him for this man the same pardon that he allowed to such as deserted of their own accord. As he cites two people gave him entree to temple treasures. there's not millions of things, but there are what Josephus deemed as significant. We don't have monies, so to speak, here, as we would say, but the wealth of, but we have objects. In the last paragraph, in paragraph E, we describe in detail the final march through the streets of Rome, the triumphal march, which was commemorated on the, eventually on the Arch of Titus, on the Arch of Titus in Rome. And of all those who had taken the temple of Jerusalem and made the greatest figure of them all, the golden table, the weight of many talents, the candlestick also was made of gold. Though he says the candlestick, when they took it through the streets of Rome, looked different than the candlestick that he knew that was in the temple. Though its construction was now changed from that which we made use of, for its middle shaft was fixed upon a basis. I guess it was a different basis than it was than the original one. And the small branches were produced out of it to a great length. There's evidently, it seems normally they were curved, so now they were straightened, having the likeness of a trident in their position. And had everyone a segment of brass for a lamp on the town. Then he continues on how it looked. The last of all the spoils was carried the law of the Jews. They took a Sefer Torah with them as well. This was the triumphal march through the streets of Rome. According to this, we have on one side, from Titus' speech, Jews had an enormous treasure. Some of that treasure was evidently taken out by the Romans, as Josephus describes, and as we brought from Ovis to Rabbi Nosson, right, that some of it are still in Rome, the table, the menorah, the foreplate. Where are they today? A. And B, are there any other treasures not mentioned in Josephus' list? You have to realize that the works, when it says, the Ovis Rabbi Nosson says that they're still lying in Rome, is something that was said 100, 120 years after the event. A lot of time has passed since then. One of the great scholars of our generation, one who put to light many of the ancient manuscripts, the manuscripts of the medieval scholars that were hidden in libraries, there's a Rabbi Moshe Yehuda Blau. And every year or so he works on the manuscripts and from different libraries and publishes them. And one of his yearly trips to Detroit, he told me the following story. There's someone who lives in Queens, he told me the shul which he davens. I think it's in Fabian Schoenfeld's Young Israel in Queens, Kew Garden Hills. Kew Gardens. That there's an engineer who used to work for General Electric. There was a conference in Italy. It was part of the conference. They took them on a tour of the Vatican Museum. This engineer took the guide aside and asked him, "Do you have anything from the Second Temple period?" He took him to a special area and he showed him the tzitz. He showed him the golden foreplate. When he came back to America, he told Rabbi Blau. Rabbi Blau's connections to the Vatican, and at least the Vatican Library, through his use of these manuscripts. He didn't really get replied, but after some 3 months, he got a reply that they can't find it anymore. What? When did this occur? A few years ago. But evidently, it seems from this story, and this is Rabbi Blau is a great scholar, that in reality the Vatican still has the tzitz. Well, if it still has the tzitz, you know, the golden fork, but it's quite likely it has the other treasures of the Roman Empire. There's one that we've quoted. Remember, we quote two kinds of midrashim. There's the mainstream midrashim, mainstream traditions, and sort of out of the pale tradition. One of those non-mainstream traditions recorded in these rare collection of midrashim states that when Mashiach comes, he will wage war with Rome and take all the vessels that reposit out of there and bring them back to Yerushalayim. Now, in 1952, there was discovered in the wilderness, in the caves in Qumran. Qumran is the area where the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in 1947. It will be the third cave that was excavated. They found a copper scroll. Actually, it was like two because it had already broken in half. It was like one on top of the other. It was some 4 years later, 1956, they took this copper scroll in a university in Manchester, England, and they were afraid to unroll it because it had corroded. So they cut it into longitudinal strips, you know, so little strips at a time. Then we take the strips and then reform them and be able to read them. And what they found was a treasure hidden some 64 places that consisted of some 3,000 talents of silver, some 1,300 talents of gold, with a tremendous, besides the listen talents, bars of silver and bars of gold and incense. Just to give you a sense of what a talent is. I said, Peter, you're so near Hollywood, you're asking what talent is.
Yeah. That's why we
asked. Yeah. A talent, and it is good in the Talmud. This is the term in the Talmud is kikor. A kikor, which is the English is talent, is 60 mona. A mona is 100 dinorim. You know, there's a coin a dinar. So 100 dinorim is a mona. 60 mona is a kikor, or we'll put it 6,000 dinars is one kikor, one talent. If we convert it into shkolim, from dinar to shekels, there are 4 dinarim in a shekel. So 4 into this, so we come out now 1,500 shkolim. From 6,000 dinars becomes 1,500 shkolim. How much is that in our weight? One shekel is approximately a half ounce. Approximately. So approximately 30 shekels, in other words, is a pound. There's normally 16 ounces in a pound. It's not exactly half an ounce, so we'll fudge it a little bit. And there's 30 shekels in a pound. Well, 30 shekels in 1 pound. We have 1,500 shkolim, so we divide 30 into 1,500, we get 50. So there are 50 pounds of in one kikor. Now, I just want to explain to you, the Gemara says in Bechoros and Daf Hei, in 5a, that there are two types of talents of kikor. There is the kikor shel chol, the normative talent, and kikor shel kodesh, the holy one, which is double weight. So it's not clear which one we're speaking about. But let's just speak, conservatively speaking, of the normative one. One talent is 50 pounds. If now I have 1,300 talents of gold, I have 65,000 pounds of gold. Now, even for me, that's a lot of money. Well, that's just the gold. Then you have in the silver, you have, you know, we have 3,000, this is 150,000 pounds of silver. And then there's a whole list of bars, and it's not clear how much these bars weigh, of gold and silver. And Like they say in French, the sach geld, you know. Just wait a second. There's a question amongst scholars, is this a legend? Perhaps similar as we saw to the Medrash that we quoted, this Maseches Kelim, that dealt with 101,200,000, you know, silver vessels or gold vessels. I mean, is it reliable? Is this some ancient tradition that perhaps being passed down has, and this again is outside of the yeshivas, and this hasn't been passed down b'diuk, and this with care, and it's reached legendary proportions, or is this actually a real list? The argument that it is a real list, which is the majority of scholars maintain, is for two reasons. First of all, there are no legends written on this. It's just simply, in this place, this much is hidden, this place, that much is hidden. It's like a, you know, it's a very straightforward list. Second of all, it's written on copper. Generally, something which is written on copper is meant to stay a long time. I mean, legends are oral, you know, or most they write them on parchment or papyrus. There's the fact that this copper really was meant, the person who's writing it, that this is it, and we want to hide this, and we want it to remain and make sure it does not decompose. If it is truly a real list, we have to ask ourselves two questions. Where are those places? There is a lot of money. Huh? And two, who hid it? There's just a list of treasures. In terms of who hid it, there are three theories, of course. One is those who were the authors of the Dead Sea Scrolls were a special sect of Jews. They were not mainstream Jews. They're very, most scholars seem to identify the people who hid those scrolls with the Essenes, which is a ascetic type of a sect that seems to have dwelled, at least according to one opinion, by the Dead Sea. It's spoken of by Philo, the Alexandrian philosopher, by Josephus, by Pliny the Elder, the Roman writer. Could this be the treasures of this sect? The argument against this is that they really took a pledge of poverty. They really were, it was like a monastic kind of a thing. They lived a Spartan type of a life. To have collected all that money does not seem that likely. There's another suggestion that perhaps this again is the temple treasures. Remember we quoted on page 7 from Titus's last speech. He says the Jews collected more money than the Romans. Perhaps maybe this is the money that was hidden. I've heard recently another theory that was given that perhaps the Jews, you know, when the Jews go up to Yerushalayim every year, they take with them monies. You know, there's Miser Sheni, and there's tithes that are taken. The second tithe, which is taken in the first, second, of the Shemitah cycle, the 7-year cycle, the first, second, fourth, and fifth year, that if one doesn't want to take the fruit up, one can redeem that fruit for money and take the money up. Perhaps you have all these Jews who went up and had all this money and were locked in, so to speak. Maybe this is the accumulation of not temple treasures, but Jewish monies that were dedicated to be used in Yerushalayim, but they couldn't go anyplace. But in any case, these were treasures that were hidden at the time of the destruction of the temple. A third theory is that there's a church tradition, I mean, from church historians, and there seems to be support from it from the Talmud, that Bar Kokhba was considering building. Bar Kokhba made the revolt some 50, 60 years after the destruction of the temple. He was considering building a temple, or started building a temple, and this may have been the monies of Bar Kokhba's temple. There is an archaeologist by the name of Wendell Jones. Wendell Jones dedicated his... What?
contents of the Tanakh.
Yes.
So, how it went together with either it's the midpoint master, Shabi, or Bar Kokhba was collecting money. Because here we are talking about real items.
Well, they're not more. It's more money than items. In other words, right. It's more or gold, silver than items. They're not real items. There are a few items there, but it's mostly gold and silver. It isn't like we have. It's mostly items. I mean, it's mostly gold, silver. Very few items relative to gold, silver. There's an archaeologist by the name of Wendell Jones, who claims that because you guys, all these places are named in ambiguous, and it's something that we cannot easily discern where these places are. And that's just 2,000 years have passed. You know, in this cave described like this and like this, this is hidden. Where are they? In 1968, this archaeologist claimed, at least he felt comfortable, that he had found, or at least identified, two of those places. There's one place called Nachal Kippa, which is the river of the dome, and he found the formation, a dome-like formation, with a wadi running by. Another one he called Moras Ha'omud, the cave of the column, which he claimed from all, I guess, all the other caves, this, I guess, would be called the cave of the column. But it wasn't until 1977 he started digging in the area which he discerns called the Cave of the Column, which is one of those caves. And for 11 years he worked without any success. In 1988, in that cave, he found in a pit 3 feet deep, and this was he found a flask, a clay, an earthenware flask, containing an oil which does not exist today. It was taken to the Weizmann Institute to test chemically. There is no such oil that exists today. But it seems that it is the Shemen Aparsimon. This is a very rare oil which is discussed in the Talmud and by Pliny and Josephus, that came from a plant which grew around that area of Qumran, Ein Gedi. And in fact, it's so important, there's a Talmudic tradition that Nebuchadnezzar, when he left over, when he had plundered the temple and took the exile, he left some Jews there. The reason he left Jews there, he left a contingent of Jews to harvest this oil in the Ein Gedi Dead Sea area. And he had another contingent of Jews to harvest the chalazon, this aquatic animal that produces the rare blue dye, the tchelis. But even the Nebuchadnezzar was concerned about this rare oil. This oil was used to anoint kings. There's a more Croesus in Hayomud Beis that describes that this was the oil that Elisha the prophet anointed Yehu. This was the oil that later on one of the Jewish kings, Yehoshaphat, was anointed with. It was a rare oil. It was a very special oil. According to one opinion, this oil, at least the byproduct of this oil, was used as one of the keteris of the incense in the temple. So he had this small vial, this flask of, at least the first report that I had was like between 1.5 and 3.5 ounces of this oil was there in this flask. It was reddish, which, as Pliny describes, that this aparsimon, this balsam oil, turned reddish with age. It was honey-like. It had, in other words, with age, it wasn't thin like oil. It was like thicker, but it was pourable. It was like honey. And he felt heartened, this Wendell Jones, that he was on to something, and he felt this identification was valid. And also, it seems then, that is not just a legendary source, but really it is a real source, this copper scroll. In 1992, digging also further in this cave of the column, he found a whole, he found 900 pounds of red dirt. This red dirt he put in his mouth, it melted in his mouth, not on his hands. And it had a slightly salty taste. He put some in a plastic bag out in the sun, and it emitted a sweet smell similar to cinnamon. They took it to the Weizmann Institute, and they claim that they have identified at least 8 of the 11 spices that are in the Ketores, are in the incense. The claim is this is the incense which was stored. There would be perhaps an argument, I'm sure, to say that then it comes from the temple rather than Bar Kokhba, if we're assuming that Bar Kokhba only attempted to build a temple, did not actually build a temple, just collected monies for it. The law is the Ketores has to be pounded in the temple. So that would add, perhaps, argue weight that really comes from the temple rather than, you know, a later time of Bar Kokhba. According to this, it would seem then that there really are buried treasures there. Two last notes for this. We're going through this period of mourning of these 3 weeks, starting with Shivasar B'Tammuz, with the 17th day of the Hebrew month of Tammuz, ending with Tisha B'Av, with the 9th month of the Hebrew, the 9th day of the Hebrew month of Av. It's hard to mourn something you've never seen. We could bemoan the fate of Jewry for thousands of years. We can bemoan the Holocaust, something of our recent history, the struggles of the people of Israel. It's hard to bemoan a temple that we've never seen. At least hopefully this lecture gives you just a sense of the immediacy and the reality of at least the articles of the temple. A second note I'd like to leave you with. Sure, a fascinating story, which relates more again to the idea of these 3 weeks than to the actual lecture. The city of Vilna in Lithuania was known as Yerushalayim de Lita. It was the Jerusalem of Lithuania. This was the place where the Vilna Gaon studied. Countless scholars were produced there. When the Nazis took over Vilna, they plundered the synagogues, they killed the inhabitants, and by the time that the first Russian troops came in to a liberated Vilna, after the Nazis had abandoned it, there were no Jews there, the residents of Vilna, and the contents, the Torahs, the shuls, had all been vandalized. Amongst the first group of Russian soldiers who came to Vilna was a Talmudic scholar who had studied in the Yeshivan Telds in Lithuania. Eventually, after escaping to Russia, became part of the Russian army and was part of the contingent of Russian troops that came to liberated Vilna. His name is Rav Isaac Osband. He is today one of the Rosh Yeshivas in the Yeshivan Telds in Cleveland. What he found there was he saw this, basically it was what had once been pride and joy, the Jerusalem, modern day Jerusalem, had been destroyed. He found one shop where it was a repository for Sifrei Torah, and the Nazis were using it to put together leather for soles of shoes, as they would cut it up and paste it to make soles, to thicken it and to make soles of shoes. What was left, as he said, put everything together. Perhaps he could piece together a whole Sefer Torah, like a little bit of this one and that one. This is all was left of all the Sifrei Torah, all the Torah scrolls of Vilna Yerushalayim of Lithuania. But he did find, oddly enough, one shul still left as it originally was. Evidently, in the middle of davening, in the middle of the prayers, they had rushed out. The Nazi soldiers came in, told everyone to leave. They padlocked this shul. And if it had been left there for 3 years in that condition, it was not opened. When Rav Ozban came there, he had the Russians open up the padlock. He came in, and it was like a scene out of Twilight Zone. It was there as it was left. The Sidurim all were opened. In other words, to where they were davening. The Chumashim were opened. You know, seat after seat. And he went, and there was a scroll, a Sefer Torah, on the bima. And it was opened. That's said, remember, this is the last Sefer Torah in all of Vilna. And it was opened to the Toichacha. It was opened to that section of the Torah that deals with the curses that will befall the Jews if they do not keep the Torah. It's an amazing thing. Imagine, the only scroll left. And this is what it's open to. It's an amazing story. Just a sense, just feeling the immediacy of this time period, to share that story with you. Are there any questions? No questions?
This is kind of like just a what's this incense business? Because we don't use it now, right?
Right. Incense was used as part of the temple service. It was used morning and night. As we said this word mona, right? Remember we had this thing mona. Mona is 100 dinorim, right? 25 shkolim, right? So if we have a half an ounce is a shekel, so it's 12 and a half ounces. Were brought on the altar every day.
Is it supposed to be like a spiritual thing?
Right, it is one of the symbolic acts that were, that, you know, that took place in the temple. Yeah.
Is the Beit HaMikdash really important? For Judaism, you know, both the monotheism, the belief in the abstract, you know, I mean, is Beit HaMikdash is not replacement of
The question is well taken. Let me just repeat that question for the audience. The question is, what is really the importance of the temple, you know, in Judaism? You know, it seems to be that the truths of Judaism are very abstract. It would seem that really prayer, which is one really communicates with God, would be the highest level, and not sacrifice, you know, not the whole temple service. I'd like you to keep three things in mind, right, just to share with you. One is that the temple service takes up a large part of the Torah, as it does a large part of the Talmud and a large part of the Rambam. And the mitzvahs associated with the temple exist for all time just like any other mitzvah, just in terms of just legalisms, not... I'm not answering your question. I just want to keep it. Yeah, I'm not answering your. I'm just putting it in perspective before I answer. But legally, all the karbonos, all the thing, exist for all time. The mitzvahs exist for all time. The Rambam, who rules that exists for all times, in the Mor Nevuchim, in the Guide to Perplexed, maintains though that its purpose was a substitute for pagan practice. It was the Torah elevated what was common pagan practice and elevated into a spiritual Jewish thing. But even the Rambam, which is his theory, But even the Rambam maintained that it's still in all will, it's part of the mitzvah of the Torah, and eventually when the temple will be rebuilt, it will function and all those mitzvahs will apply, even though the rationale may not necessarily be there. However, the view of what we call the mystical school, the Ramban, Nachmanides, and really virtually all the Mekubalim, to this day, the Vilner Gaon, the famous Gaon of Vilna, and his disciples, maintained that the process of bringing sacrifice has a profound mystical effect on the whole creation. And there's really a real effect that occurs. It would be akin to if I can affect something electromagnetically. In other words, I don't see it, but there is a real effect. According to the Kabbalah, there is built into the Bria a real effect. So that when one brings a sacrifice, one is making a significant change in the whole, we call the metaphysical world. And that really is the, according to them, it isn't merely, it has it, of course, just a symbolism, because there is an element of symbolism that a person, this is a, vicariously, the animal dies where the person feels he should die, you know, for his sins. Besides this, there is a real Kabbalistic, metaphysical act that is doing, which is really changes, just as one doesn't see a person, just as an example, of course, one has, God forbid, he has a cancer, and they give him radiation treatment. Radiation is not something we normally see, it's not, but it's something that affects the body. I mean, akin, I mean, very light, I mean, just... The korbanos are something which affect the whole universe, the whole cosmos. So according to that view, which is the Kabbalistic view, and it's maintained just, you know, not by a fringe element, but it's very widespread, that really it is a very, very significant act. Again, that doesn't deny the major place of belief, you know, avas Hashem, as love of God and fear of God, midos, the person to develop into a superior human being, which perhaps if one would live with the highest thing. But it doesn't deny the place of korbanos, of sacrifice. Any other questions? Okay.
Yes. It seems for Wendell Jones' theory to be right,
let me explain. There's a major historical problem. Understand the events of the Second Temple is because those who are writing our history books have only one really resource to rely on, and that's Josephus. And they don't have really Talmudic sources to rely upon. It's clear in Talmudic sources are those that control this temple in terms of how the service worked in the temple, and every day how it was controlled by Chazal, by the teachers of the Mishnah, we call the Pharisees. They controlled it. There was a Bezdin Shel Kohanim, there was a court of the Kohanim, and they produced the guidelines, you know, and they actually ran the show, so to speak. And if it had been the decision of the Bezdin, of the court, that much of it should be preserved, it would have been preserved. It was not a free-for-all. The Sadducees may have had certain positions they had, and they had controls of certain things. The populace were behind the Pharisees, and they exerted an enormous control. You know, so I don't... we can only speculate how that money got there, and that's because we don't have a clear thing. But I don't think the fact is that you had corrupt Kohanim there would have stopped it if the Beis Din had made a determination that's where they should have gone. Yes.
Yeah. Well, one thinks it's 600,000 and 1,000,000.
What may be that number of 120,000 perhaps is a symbolic number, and this midrash is really then more of a Kabbalistic, in other words, a symbolic or an allegorical account rather than a real historical account. That may be a possibility. It's quoted in a Kabbalistic work. So it could be that there's more to it than just a real historical account. But as a historical account, it creates a lot of problems.
Why do you think the Vatican...
The question was asked, first of all, so why would the Vatican want to hide the fact that they have these treasures? And two, is there some way that we can put pressure on them to get them back, right? That's the basically the question you're asking. You know, the Catholic Church has a very hard problem with us. You know, we shouldn't be here. You know, just we shouldn't be here. You know, 2,000 years we denied the believing in the, you know, in the founder of Christianity. We should be condemned to total destruction. We came out, built this beautiful state in Israel. We're doing fine. You know, there are yeshivas all over the world, and that Sefer Torah is being read from Anchorage, Alaska, to who knows, to Buenos Aires in Argentina. Like, the Torah is being learned. The Israelis have a state, Baruch Hashem, that the Judaism is continuing on. It's very uncomfortable being a Catholic these days. It would be a real fear if that third temple really got off the ground, wouldn't it? And I think that they really don't want anything that would begin the process of building a third temple, that they would like to hand it over. On the other hand, you're talking about pressure being put on them. In terms of, you know, we look at the thing as a sacred item. Let's just take a Sefer Torah, for instance, just as an example. It's a sacred item. We put it in a special, you know, there are different customs. The Ashkenazi custom is that we have a, you know, a special mantle, like a special covering over it. I think we put it in Aron Kodesh, we put it in an ark, and on the ark, you know, very often we have a curtain on top. We hide it. There's a thing of tznius, of modesty, and there's a certain dignity afforded to it. Imagine, if you will, which does happen sometimes, they have a Sefer Torah in a museum. You know, it's opened, and they put a pin here and here and here, right? And it's under glass, and look, hey, mommy, look at that, you know? It takes away from the covet, from the dignity of, you know, of the Sefer Torah. I don't know if it's a service for these articles if they'd be put in the Israeli museum and everyone will just go back and forth and look, you know, and it just becomes a museum piece. And maybe it's a greater honor for it that it's hidden somewhere in some room and no one ever sees it until Amir Tzashem it'll be used again. There are... No, well, the thing is like this. There are... the word Jesus is used some 20, 30 times in the works of Josephus as a name. It's Yoshua, of Joshua. It just so happens that... It just so happens that there are three mentions in places in the works of Josephus that parallel the New Testament. There's one, a short thing about Jesus himself, the author of the New Testament, not the author, the subject of the New Testament, a small thing in the 18th chapter. There is a reference to John the Baptist and his being killed, and there's a reference to James, the brother of Jesus, being killed. And there's a question among scholars: is this is originally, you know, thing, or this was added? It seems that they were discovered recently a version of Josephus that did not have these, so which would add credence that actually they were added later on. Okay.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.